Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and this is Side 2 of For the Record program number 416, titled Fascism, Islamism, and Terrorism, being recorded on July 14th of the year 2003. Now, we're going to proceed directly to Part 2 of a series that was published by the Asia Times, a respected English-language daily out of Hong Kong. This series, from which this broadcast takes its title, I've inverted it slightly. The series is titled Islamism, Fascism, and Terrorism. It's a four-part series from the Asia Times at www.atimes.com. The author is Mark Erickson, that's capital M-A-R-C, capital E-R-I-K-S-O-N, and the broadcast, the series, again, is available at www.atimes.com. And this is a series that compares Islamic extremism and fascism and the two movements' influence on terrorism. And again, I would submit that in its post-World War II manifestation, Islamism or Islamofascism, in particular the Muslim Brotherhood's brand of Islamic extremism, would indeed be classified as an Islamic form of fascism. There are profound differences between various forms of fascism, in particular the Japanese form of fascism and its European counterparts. I believe that that is characteristic of many different manifestations of this political movement, but I believe that there are very strong links between Islamofascism and its European forebears. I also believe that the Bush administration is a front for the underground Reich. As preposterous as that will seem to some, I do not believe that the overwhelming majority of people in it are aware of that connection, but more about that in the many descriptions to the broadcast. I simply cannot sum that up in the time allotted here. Perhaps in a sort of a fireside chat by way of concluding the events, the long series on September 11th, I'll give my viewpoint on just how some of the pieces of the whole fit together, because I can appreciate that that will be puzzling or perhaps vexing to some members of the listening audience. In any event, Part 2 of Islamism, Fascism, and Terrorism from the Asia Times, this is by Mark Erickson. And there's a very interesting allegation at the end of this article, which is that although there's no source here, that Youssef Nada helped to effect the escape of the Grand Mufti, Haj Amin al-Husseini, from Germany at the end of 1945. If, in fact, that's the case, and I would note that in the book Dollars for Terror, it is alleged by Richard LaBeviere, in turn accessing information from Egyptian intelligence files, that Youssef Nada worked for the Abwehr of Admiral Wilhelm Canaris. Youssef Nada is a defendant in the lawsuit against the perpetrators of September 11th, and if the allegation with which this part of the series concludes is accurate, namely that he helped the Grand Mufti escape from Germany, that would be very interesting indeed. In the three parts of the series that we're going to present here, we're going to trace more of the evolution of the Muslim Brotherhood during the World War II period. We're going to take a look at the post-war influence of Sayyid Qutb on the Muslim Brotherhood, and in turn we're going to take a look at the evolution of the Muslim Brotherhood's ideology on up through Ayman al-Zawahiri, the political mentor many believe to Osama bin Laden, and the number two man by most accounts in the al-Qaeda network. Osama bin Laden has the money, proven organizational skills, combat experience, and the charisma that confer the air of wisdom and profundity, even on inchoate or trivial utterances, and let what's unfathomable appear to be deep in the eyes of his followers. But bin Laden is no intellectual. The brains of al-Qaeda and its chief ideologue, by most accounts, is Egyptian physician Ayman al-Zawahiri, 51, the organization's number two man, and former head of the Egyptian al-Jihad, which was merged with bin Laden's outfit in February of 1998 to form the, quote, International Front for Fighting Jews and Crusaders, unquote. Al-Zawahiri hails from an elite Egyptian family. His father was a professor at Cairo University's medical school, from which Ayman graduated in 1974. His paternal grandfather was the Grand Imam at the Al-Azhar Institute, Sunni Islam's paramount seat of learning. His great-uncle, Abdel Rahman Azam, was the first Secretary General of the Arab League. Such family background notwithstanding, or perhaps partly because of it, al-Zawahiri joined the Radical Islamist Muslim Brotherhood, or al-Ikhwan al-Muslimun, as a young boy, and was for the first time arrested in 1966 at age 15 when the secular government of President Gamal Abdel Nasser rounded up thousands of al-Ikhwan members and executed its top leaders in retribution for repeated assassination attempts on the president. One of those executed by hanging was Chief Ideologue Saeed Qutb. That's spelled, by the way, Q-U-T-B. I may be mispronouncing that. Al-Zawahiri is Qutb's intellectual heir. He has further developed his message and is putting it into practice. But without Qutb, present-day Islamism is a noxious amalgam of fascist totalitarianism and extremes of Islamic fundamentalism would not exist. His principal accomplishment, unquote, was to articulate the social and political practices of the Muslim Brotherhood from the 1930s through the 1950s, including collaboration with fascist regimes and organizations, involvement in anti-colonial, anti-Western, and anti-Israeli actions, and the struggle for state power in Egypt, in demagogically persuasive fashion buttressed by tendentious references to Islamic law and scriptures to deceive the faithful. Qutb, a one-time literary critic, was not a religious fundamentalist but a Goebbels-style propagandist for a new totalitarianism to stand side-by-side with fascism and communism. Hitler's early 1933 accession to power in Germany was widely cheered by Arabs of all different political persuasions. When the Third Reich spook and horrors were over 12 years later, a favorite excuse among those who felt the need for one was that the Nazis had been allies against the colonial oppressors and Zionist intruders, unquote. Many felt no need for an excuse at all and simply bemoaned the fact that the Nazis' final solution to the, quote, Jewish problem, unquote, had not proved final enough. But affinities with fascism on the part of the Muslim Brotherhood and other segments of Arab and Muslim society went much deeper than collaboration with the enemy of one's enemies, and collaboration itself took some extreme forms. Indeed, as I mentioned at the beginning of the broadcast, the scapegoating of Jews in Israel in particular for the problems of the Muslim world, the Arab world in particular, and the equation of Zionism with control of the United States, which one also sees in some of these same formulations, are among the things that I think distinguish post-World War II Islamism as a form of Islamo-fascism, in particular the Islamism that has become peculiar to the Al-Qaeda descendants of the Muslim Brotherhood. I also think that with people like Ahmed Huber or Johann von Leers, later Omar Amin von Leers, both of whom converted to Islam, but yet both of whom also maintained a strong either ideological fascination with or actual operational links with European pagan movements, far-right pagan movements such as the Avalon Gemeinschaft in the case of Ahmed Huber, and Johann von Leers' fascination with various forms of occultism or solar societies, as von Leers referred to them, are indicative of the overall fascist agenda of these converts to Islam. And I think that the term Islamo-fascism is one to consider very carefully in this regard, and the utilization of the Muslim world, in particular the Arab world, as combatants on behalf of an underground Reich is one that I think deserves to be taken very seriously indeed. Indeed, I think that's one of the things that we're facing in connection with September 11th, although I think many of the people involved in many of these machinations are only aware of some, if any, of these connections. Continuing. Substitute religious for racial purity, the idealized Ummah of the rule of four righteous caliphs of the mid-7th century for the mythical Aryan Volksgemeinschaft and most ideological and organization precepts of Nazism laid out by chief theoretician Alfred Rosenberg in his work The Myth of the 20th Century and by Adolf Hitler in Mein Kampf, and later put into practice, are in all essential respects identical to the precepts of the Muslim Brotherhood after its initial phase as a group promoting spiritual and moral reform. This ranges from radical rejection of decadent, unquote, Western political and economic liberalism, instead embracing the leadership principle and corporatist organization of the economy, to endorsement of the use of terror and assassinations to seize and hold state power, and all the way to concoction of fantastical anti-Semitic conspiracy theories linking international plutocratic finance to Freemasonry, Zionism, and all-encompassing Jewish world control. Not surprisingly, then, as Italian and German fascism sought greater stakes in the Middle East in the 1930s and 1940s to counter British and French controlling power, close collaboration between fascist agents and Islamist leaders ensued. During the 1936-39 Arab Revolt, Admiral Wilhelm Canaris, head of German military intelligence, sent agents and money to support the Palestine uprising against the British, as did Muslim Brotherhood founder and supreme guide Hassan al-Banna. A key individual in the fascist-Islamist nexus and go-between for the Nazis and al-Banna became the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem, Haji Amin al-Husseini, incidentally the later mentor from 1946 onward of a young firebrand by the name of Yasser Arafat. Having fled from Palestine to Iraq, al-Husseini assisted there in the short-lived April 1941 Nazi-inspired and financed anti-British coup. By June of 1941, British forces had reasserted control in Baghdad, and the Mufti was on the run again, this time via Tehran and Rome to Berlin, to a hero's welcome. He remained in Germany as an honored guest and valuable intelligence and propaganda asset throughout most of the war, met with Hitler on several occasions, and personally recruited leading members of the Bosnian Muslim Hanjar or Sabre Division of the Waffen-SS. Another valued World War II Nazi collaborator was Josef Nada, current board chairman of Al-Taqwa, Nada Management, the Lugano, Switzerland, Liechtenstein, and Bahamas-based financial services outfit accused by the Treasury Department of money laundering for and financing of Osama bin Laden's Al-Qaeda. As a young man, he had joined the armed branch of the secret apparatus, or Al-Jihaz al-Siri of the Muslim Brotherhood, and then was recruited by German military intelligence. And again, note the following allegation. This is not sourced, so I obviously am not in a position to vouch for this, but this is very interesting indeed. When Grand Mufti al-Husseini had to flee Germany in 1945 as the Nazi defeat loomed, Nada reportedly was instrumental in arranging the escape via Switzerland back to Egypt and eventually Palestine, where al-Husseini resurfaced in 1946. So according to this article, Yusef Nada was allegedly involved in helping the escape of the Grand Mufti from Jerusalem, or from Germany, excuse me, where he eventually wound up in Palestine. If in fact that's the case, that would draw yet the connections between the Islamo-fascism of the World War II period and the Islamo-fascism of the contemporary period and that manifested by Al-Qaeda closer still. Now, the third part of this series, again, Islamism, Fascism, and Terrorism by Mark Erickson of the Asia Times, read as follows. Islamism, or fascism with an Islamic face, was born with and of the Muslim Brotherhood. It proved and improved its fascist core convictions and practices through collaboration with the Nazis in the run-up to and during World War II. It proved it during the same period through its collaboration with the overtly fascist Young Egypt, or Misr al-Fatah movement, founded in October of 1933 by lawyer Ahmed Hussein and modeled directly on the Hitler Party, complete with paramilitary green shirts aping the Nazi brown shirts, Nazi salute, and literal translations of Nazi slogans. Among its members, Young Egypt counted two promising youngsters and later presidents, Gamal Abdel Nasser and Anwar al-Sadat. By the way, I want to note in passing, as I've stressed in a number of past broadcasts, the secular Arabo-fascists, such as the Green Shirts or the Baathists in Syria and Iraq, organization, the latter organization having also borrowed from Stalinist ideology, even though I think both would be, certainly the Green Shirts and Baathists classified as fascist, there are sharp divisions between the Green Shirts and the Baathists and the Islamo-fascist Muslim Brotherhood, and indeed in a number of past interviews, instances, in particular in Syria in 1982, the Ba'athists murderously cracked down on the Muslim Brotherhood. Indeed, the Egyptian stance toward the Muslim Brotherhood has vacillated. Anwar Sadat actually brought the Muslim Brotherhood out of the shadows, so to speak, in order to help suppress the Egyptian left. And then later, after his detente with Israel, the Muslim Brotherhood, or elements associated with it, assassinated him. But do note the difference between the green shirt secular Arabo-fascists and the Islamo-fascists here. Continuing with the series, or with part three of the series, in later years, the Brotherhood had serious fallings out with Nasser, whom it attempted to assassinate on several different occasions, and with Sadat, whom it did assassinate in 1981. But up until at least the time of Nasser's 1952 coup d'etat, all was sweetness and light between Hassan al-Banna's brethren and Nasser's free officers, unquote. In his personal diary, Sadat wrote in the summer of 1940, quote, "One day I invited Hassan al-Banna, leader of the Muslim Brotherhood, to the army camp where I served in the Egyptian Communication Corps, so that he might lecture before my soldiers on various religious topics. A few days before his scheduled appearance, it was reported to me from army intelligence that his coming was forbidden and canceled by the order of General Headquarters, and I myself was summoned for interrogation. After a short while, I went secretly to Albana's office and participated in a few seminars he organized. I liked the man and admired him," unquote. Whether Albana, who had already been in contact with German agents since the 1936-39 Palestine uprising against the British, or someone else introduced Sadat and his free officer comrades to German military intelligence is not known. But in the summer of 1942, when Rommel's Africa Corps stood just 100 kilometers from Alexandria and were poised to march into Cairo, Sadat, Nasser, and their buddies were in close touch with the German attacking force and, with Brotherhood help, preparing an anti-British uprising in Egypt's capital. A treaty with Germany, including provisions for German recognition of an independent but pro-Axis Egypt, had been drafted by Sadat, guaranteeing that, quote, "No British soldier would leave Cairo alive," unquote. When Rommel's push east failed at El Alamein in the fall of 1942, Sadat and several of his co-conspirators were arrested by the British and sat out much of the remainder of the war in jail. Islamist-fascist collaboration did not cease with war's end. King Farouk brought large numbers of German military and intelligence personnel, as well as ranking ex-Nazis, into Egypt as advisors. It was a bad move, as several of the Germans, recognizing Farouk's political weakness, soon began conspiring with Nasser and his free officers, who in turn were working closely with the Brotherhood to overthrow the king. On July 23, 1952, the deed was done, and Newsweek marveled that, quote, "The most intriguing aspect of the revolt was the role played in the coup by the large group of German advisors serving with the Egyptian army. The young officers who did the actual planning consulted the German advisors as to tactics, and this accounted for the smoothness of the operation." By the way, I would note that both Werner Naumann and his network and Johann von Leers were in Egypt during this time period, and that the Naumann network apparently had a lot to do with helping to arrange the overthrow of King Farouk. And Johann von Leers later played a key role in Egypt under Nasser. And it was Johann von Leers who served as a mentor, along with the Grand Mufti, to Ahmed Huber of Al-Taqwa. Continuing. And yet another player, fond of playing all sides against the middle, had entered the game prior to Farouk's ouster. In 1951, the CIA's Kermit Roosevelt, grandson of President Teddy Roosevelt, who in 1953 would organize the overthrow of elected Iranian leader Mohammad Mossadegh and install Reza Pahlavi as Shah, opened secret negotiations with Nasser. Agreement was soon reached that the U.S. post-coup would assist in building Egypt's intelligence and security forces in the obvious manner by reinforcing Nasser's existing Germans with additional more capable ones. For that, the CIA head Alan Dulles turned to Reinhard Gehlen, one-time head of Eastern Front German military intelligence and by the early 1950s in charge of developing a new German foreign intelligence service. Gehlen hired the best man he knew for the job, former SS Colonel Otto Skorzeny, who at the end of the war had organized the infamous Odessa Network to facilitate the escape of high-ranking Nazis to Latin America, mainly Perón's Argentina, and Egypt. With Skorzeny now on the job of assisting Nasser, Egypt became a safe haven for Nazi criminals galore. The CIA officer in charge of the Egypt assistance program was Miles Copeland, soon a Nasser intimate. And then things got truly complicated and messy. Having played a large role in Nasser's power grab, the Muslim Brotherhood, after the 1949 assassination of Hassan al-Banna by government agents under new leadership, and since 1951 under the radical ideological guidance of Sayyid Qutb, demanded its due imposition of Sharia, or Islamic religious law. When Nasser demurred, he became a Brotherhood assassination target, but with CIA and the German mercenaries' help, he prevailed. In February of 1954, the Brotherhood was banned. An October 1954 assassination attempt failed. 4,000 brothers were arrested, 6 were executed, and thousands fled to Syria, Saudi Arabia, Jordan, and Lebanon. Within short order, things got more tangled still. As Nasser, in his brewing fight with Britain and France over control of the Suez Canal, turned to the Soviet Union for assistance and arms purchases, the CIA approached and began collaboration with the Brotherhood against their ex-ally, the now pro-Soviet Nasser. We leave that twisted tale at this stage. A leading Brotherhood member arrested in 1954 was Sayyid Qutb. He spent the next 10 years in Jarrah prison near Cairo, and there wrote the tracts that subsequently became, and till this day remain, must reading and guidance for Islamists everywhere. The main translations into Farsi were made by the Rabar of the Islamic Republic of Iran, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei. But while Brother Number One went to jail, other leading members who would escape were given jobs in Saudi universities and provided with royal funding. They included Saeed's brother Muhammad and Abdullah al-Azam, the radical Palestinian preacher, the Emir of Jihad, who later, in Peshawar, Pakistan, founded the Maktab al-Khidmat, or Office of Services, which became the core of the Al-Qaeda network. And this is the evolution of the Muslim Brotherhood into the overlapping but not coterminous Al-Qaeda network. As a student at King Abdulaziz University in Jeddah, Osama bin Laden, son of Mohammed bin Laden, the kingdom's wealthiest contractor and close friend of King Faisal, became a disciple of Muhammad Qutb and al-Azam. Sayyid Qutb was born in 1906 in a small village in Upper Egypt and was educated at a secular college and subsequently worked as an inspector of schools for the Ministry of Education. In the 1930s and 1940s, nothing pointed to his later role. He wrote literary criticism, hung out in coffee houses, and published a novel which flopped. His conversion to radical Islam came during 2.5 years of graduate studies and education in the United States, 1948 through 51. He came to hate everything American, described churches as, quote, entertainment centers and sexual playgrounds, unquote, was shocked by the freedom allowed to women, and immediately upon his return to Egypt joined the Muslim Brotherhood and assumed the position of editor-in-chief of the organization's newspaper. While in jail, Qutb wrote a 30-volume commentary on the Quran, but his most influential book, published in 1965 after his 1964 release from prison for health reasons, was Malim Fi Tariq, or Signposts on the Road, also translated as Milestones. In it, he revised Hassan al-Banna's concept of establishing an Islamic state in Egypt after the nation was thoroughly Islamized, advocating instead, fascist or Bolshevik style, that a revolutionary vanguard should first seize state power and then impose Islamization from above. Trouble is, this recipe went against the unambiguous Muslim prohibition against overthrowing a Muslim ruler. Qutb found his clue to resolving the dilemma in the writings of his Pakistani contemporary Sayyid Abdul Allah Maududi, 1903-79, founder in 1941 of the Jamaat-e-Islami, who had denounced the existing political order in Muslim societies as partial Jaliha, representing the state of unenlightened savagery, ignorance, and idolatry of pre-Islamic Arab societies. There was nothing, quote, partial, unquote, about the Jalia of the existing order, nothing that could be redeemed, pronounced Khattab, quote, a society whose legislation does not rest on divine law is not Muslim, however ardently its individuals may proclaim themselves Muslim, even if they pray, fast, and make the pilgrimage. Jalia takes the form of claiming the right to create values, to legislate rules of collective behavior, and to choose any way of life that rests with me without regard to what God has prescribed. Unquote. Only uncompromising restoration of the ideal of the union of religion and state, as evidenced during the 7th century reign of the righteous caliphs, would do. Islam was a complete system of life not in need of man-made additions. Any ruler, Muslim or otherwise, standing in the way could be justifiably removed by any means. This naturally applied to Nasser, and another attempt on his life was made in 1965. Khattab was rearrested, tortured, and tried for prison. On August 29, 1966, he was hanged. The charge against him of plotting to establish a Marxist regime in Egypt was ludicrous. Nasser and his minions knew full well that the real danger to the regime stemmed from Khattab's denunciation of it as Jalaya and not from those clauses of his Malam Fil Tariq, which speak of a classless society in which the, quote, selfish individual, unquote, and the, quote, exploitation of man by man, unquote, would be abolished, which the prosecution cited as evidence against him. The martyred Khattab's writings rapidly acquired a wide acceptance in the Arab world, especially after the ignominious defeat of the Arabs in the June 1967 Six-Day War with Israel, taken as proof of the depth of depravity to which the regimes in the Muslim realm had sunk. And then of some of the heritage going from Sayyid Khattab to Ayman al-Zawahiri, mentor to Osama bin Laden, and viewed by many as the chief ideologue of al-Qaeda. This from Islamism, Fascism, and Terrorism, Part 4, from the Asia Times, by Mark Erickson. An early convert to Sayyid Khattab's newfangled fascist Islamism, which condones, indeed commands, terrorism and murder, was the alleged number two man of Osama bin Laden's al-Qaeda, Ayman al-Zawahiri. Having joined the Muslim Brotherhood at age 15, he was caught in the Nasser dragnet after the 1965 assassination attempt on the Egyptian leader, and, young age and elite family background notwithstanding, was thrown in jail. An April 1968 amnesty freed most of the brethren, and Ayman, in that regard, following in his father's footsteps, went on to Cairo University to become a physician. He obtained his degree in 1974 and practiced medicine for several years. And skipping down, his profession, however, was not his calling. By the late 1970s, he was back full-time in the Islamist revolution business, agitating against the Egypt-Israel peace treaty concluded in 1979. In 1980, on the introduction by military intelligence officer Abud al-Zumar, he became a leading member of the Jamaat al-Jihad of Muhammad Abed al-Salam Faraj, which on October 6, 1981, assassinated President Anwar al-Sadat while he was reviewing a military parade. And then skipping down, following the Sadat assassination, al-Zawahiri was arrested on a minor weapons possession charge and spent 3 years in jail. In 1985, he left Egypt for Saudi Arabia and later Peshawar, Pakistan, where he was joined by Muhammad al-Islambouli, the brother of one of Sadat's five assassins, 24-year-old artillery lieutenant Khalid Ahmed Shaki al-Islambouli. There, connections were made with the groups of Palestinian Islamist Abdullah Azzam and the latter's one-time student Osama bin Laden, by then fully engaged with well-known CIA support in assisting the Mujahideen struggle against Soviet occupation of Afghanistan. And the rest, as they say, is quite well-known. This concludes Side 2 of For the Record program number 416, Fascism, Islamism, and Terrorism, being recorded on July 14th of 2003. My name's Dave Emery.